The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Just days after saying he wanted much of the country to open by Easter, President Trump has now extended social distancing guidelines through the end of April. Now, even with those restrictions in place, health officials fear the U.S. could face 200,000 deaths from the virus. And without precautionary measures, that number could jump into the millions.
This morning, a mind-boggling report on layoffs. More than 6.6 million Americans filing new claims for unemployment insurance last week, the largest number in a single week ever, and two times as many as the week before.
And it's hard to even wrap your head around these gigantic numbers. The most optimistic takeaway is that Americans are doing what they've been told. Businesses are shuttered. People are staying indoors. But more than 6 million people were laid off last week. 6.6 million plus people laid off in a single week. That is the equivalent of all of Houston, all of Phoenix, all of Philadelphia, and all of San Jose. Every man, woman, and child in those cities laid off in a single week.
Jason, have we seen the bottom in the near term? And I ask this because investors are looking past a devastating jobless claims report, which is the closest thing we have to real-time economic data. And they're also responding positively to a vague tweet from the president on oil prices.
Scarlett, my own view is that bottoming will be a process. I know that's a cliche, but I do believe it's true. I do believe we've probably seen the lows, but I also just recognizing how unusual this is in terms of economic activity, shutting the economy down by fiat, by choice, and also the problems that you're going to have, long-term problems you're going to have in the credit markets. It's hard for me to think that, you know, you have the all clear here.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
U.S. employers shed more jobs in March since the darkest days of the 2007 and 2009 recession. The unemployment rate rose to 4.4% from 3.5% in February. And according to Oxford Economics, they're projecting a loss of 28 million American jobs by summer with an unemployment rate of 16%. Even the Congressional Budget Office is predicting a 10% unemployment rate by the end of Q2. We haven't seen 10% since the depths of the Great Recession. As the government blows a big hole in the economy as a result of shutdowns and quarantines, last week markets were euphoric over the stimulus. This week, once again, pessimism returns as the weight of economic shocks weigh on stocks. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplav, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me this week will be Dave Nikoski from Vermilion. Dave has never seen a market drop this fast or a market this volatile, nor the quick rotations we are now seeing in and out of ETFs. It has become, according to Dave, a stock picker's market. Strong gold market, however, is holding up well, and he sees better days for gold in the months ahead. Robert Rapier will be joining me as we take a look at the energy market. Robert has never seen a decline in energy this quick, with demand destruction could rise as high as 20 million barrels a day. Well, no kidding. If planes aren't flying and you're not driving, we're not consuming oil. According to Robert, this is the perfect energy storm. Demand destruction and a supply surplus from American shale in a price war between the Saudis and the Russians. He thinks the big companies will survive. He's not sure of the rest of the industry as several smaller shale companies filed for bankruptcy this week. Later on in the program, we will have another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's look at market-moving events with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. Given the stormy volatility in the market over the past month, this week really felt like a breather. And the biggest question on all of our minds, I think, is whether the storm is over or are we just in the eye of it? I'd like to take this opportunity to reference some data points Howard Marks, co-chairman and co-founder of Oaktree Capital Management, offered in a memo this week to kind of summarize just the incredible moves we've seen in the equity and credit markets. So let's take a look here at what he said. On February 19th to March 23rd, that route was one of the quickest routes in history for a loss of 33.9% on the S&P 500. And then after that, one of the best three-day stretches of gains since 1930s. From February 27th to March 27th, so a month here, there were 18 days with greater than 2% swings in the S&P 500. 11 of them were up, 7 of them were down, including some of the biggest daily percentage moves since 1933 and the second biggest percentage loss since 1940, exceeded only by the Black Monday in 1987. So incredible days that we're in. And some other statistics here that few are privy to is regarding the credit markets, something that we watch the Dow Jones Industrial Average, we watch the S&P 500 average. So we know what's always going on in equities. Maybe we're looking at commodity charts and understand that, or maybe what's going on in the 10-year yield. But how many truly follow the credit markets looking at pricing of individual bonds? That's something that we do on a regular basis. So we've been taking advantage of a lot of that mispricing of credit activity in the past week. But just I want to show you some of the notes here that Howard mentioned. After a complete collapse of interest to buy corporate bonds, which not many, again, saw, since the backing of the Fed's credit facility, 49 companies have issued $107 billion of investment-grade bonds. That's the biggest week for issuance on record and part of the biggest month on record if you include the week with the month being around $213 billion from 106 issuers. And that's now part of the biggest quarter on record of around $473 billion, almost half a trillion dollars in credit of corporate debt issuance. And he went on to state that last week's issuance was more than 9 out of the last 12 months in 2019, if you put it all together and what just happened in a week. It's just incredible. Incredible moves in the market and it just incredible times. And as I stated last week, the hardest part is still ahead with the unknowns of when will the cases decelerate of COVID-19, when will businesses reopen, and when will economic activity improve? Will it be a V-like recovery or a slow and steady one? Can the virus mutate? Will the U.S. suffer more without a command government to mandate nationwide social distancing? I saw it. I was out on my motorcycle a week ago on Saturday going up the 101 in California, in San Diego, and the beaches were packed. I think a lot of people had some cabin fever, but it boggled me that here it was. When people have been asked to stay off the beaches, they were completely packed. There was no parking, and there was a campsite that was completely full up a street. Just incredible. Driving through the cities, it's like a ghost town. So, you know, with fiscal and monetary stimulus behind us now, you know, both entities have stated they have more levers to pull. So we know that. I've said, again, the hardest part is still ahead. And maybe not the same level of volatility and momentum like we've already seen, in my opinion. I think that's behind us. And that's relevant if you look at the volatility index. The VIX continues to communicate that it's off from its highs from a week ago. But definitely, we are still in unknown waters with this virus. But let me continue this week with some of the measures and catalysts that have shed some light. And the first of which is an announcement by President Trump that the shut-in guidance for the country has been pushed out to the end of April. And this was viewed in positive light since his early guidance of April 12th was seen as not long enough to help contain the virus. So the market responded very positively to that news on Monday. Additionally, on Monday, there was a nice uptick in the market due to Johnson & Johnson's news of a human testing for the vaccine that will basically be set in September. And then finally, the White House consultant for COVID-19, Dr. Fauci, stated social distancing is having a positive effect with a reasonable chance for a second wave of COVID-19 in the fall, but it would not be as bad as the first wave due to vaccines and recovered individuals who have a harder chance of obtaining it again. So those were hopeful comments and followed by sobering comments, unfortunately, on Tuesday from President Trump, again stating that the worst is yet to come. With this outbreak, deaths are right ahead of us, and he expects that death toll to range between 100,000 to 250,000, possibly more. Nobody knows. And in similar fashion, trading last week, the market gapped down at the open on that news, and we've basically been trading sideways since, which is encouraging to me considering the rest of the information we got, which is essentially bad unemployment claims and a bad, and I call it a pre-bad, bad payroll report from Friday, because the data that we're seeing in the payroll data is really only up to data as of March 12th. So I do expect it to get worse in the month ahead. But unemployment claims shot up another 3.3 million up to around 6.64 million total. And the jobs report was only for, like I mentioned, just add up to the 12th. And that was seen as a decline of 701,000 jobs in March, with an unemployment rate that has risen from 3.5% to 4.4%. And that's likely, like I said, it's headed higher. But what caught the attention of our firm was how well U.S. stocks have really held up in light of that terrible data. I think maybe many knew it was coming, but you know, there is the Fed and fiscal stimulus, which I think a lot of investors feel is the catalyst to help sustain the market through this. Again, it's all unknown, folks, of how long this is going to go and how long it's going to take to get those checks and who potentially can or won't get checks. You know, businesses are applying for loans. I know our bank is opening up today on Friday, Wells Fargo, and the link is still not available. It's not ready yet. So it just appears that of the negative catalysts a month ago, some of those may be reversing soon. Trump tweeted Thursday that he had a good conversation with the Saudi prince, who in turn spoke with Russian President Putin to end the oil price wars. Again, that was a major factor in some of the weakness that we saw in the markets, with that lumped on to what we were already seeing in equities and businesses shutting down and that concern. But basically, seeing an oil price war, that didn't help matters. And it sounds like possibly we'll be looking at about 10 million barrels being removed from supply and potentially more. On that news, oil surged and oil stocks with it. As in the last time oil dropped this low, there have been big concerns over high yield paper in the energy sector. So this was good news for them, good news for the credit markets, and it may have helped to offset some of that bad economic data that we got late in the week. And that's it for me. This week's main catalysts were the extension of the shut-in guidance by Trump, some real big news in the oil markets between Saudi Arabia and Russia, and then again, the economic news that we're finally seeing the COVID-19 virus taking its toll on the U.S. economy. I greatly encourage any listeners, I mentioned some of the statistics that were from Howard Marks' memo that came out, I think, a day ago. Great summary of the bull and bear case up until now. So I really encourage any of those. I think Jim might be linking that out on his Twitter account. But Warren Buffett has said, when Howard sends out a memo, it's the first thing he opens in his email. So definitely recommend it. It's a great summary of where things are at.
The New York Stock Exchange announced an unprecedented step. After 228 years, the NYSE finally closed their floors. So now it's just machines, automation, and fully electronic trading. And there's a fascinating book that was just released talking about the historical process of automating finance over time, titled Automating Finance, Infrastructures, Engineers, and the Making of Electronic Markets. The author is Juan Pablo, a sociologist at the University of California, San Diego. So Juan, let's start with this unprecedented major step that just took place, NYSE closing its floors after 228 years. Obviously, your book is all about the evolution of going from a bunch of people yelling their different trades back and forth to the point where now we have markets heavily dominated by algorithms, by automation, high frequency trading, fully electronic. And it seems like the coronavirus has finally solidified that transition.
Yes, that is completely the case. The crisis with the coronavirus has essentially revealed the true operation of the market. Since the early 2000s, 2005, 2008, most of the trading activity was already electronic. And what we've seen recently is just a shift to, or a recognition of the fact that the trading floor was, as most people call it, a very convenient backdrop for reporting on financial news. The New York Stock Exchange's trading floor does perform some functions, but again, most of the activity in the last 10 to 15 years has taken place online in the networks of the exchange and other competing exchanges and trading venues that are now really the sites where finance happens.
So that was just a small portion of our interview with Juan Pablo on his book, Automating Finance, Infrastructures, Engineers, and the Making of Electronic Markets, where we discussed the evolution of automating finance, starting from the London Stock Exchange all the way up to today, including a very interesting look at what might happen in the future. If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our other three interviews airing every week on FS Insider, through our website, or through a podcast app of your choice, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, markets are down a little bit this week. We started out flat. We're down on Wednesday, but we got a little bit of an uptick on Thursday, the day we're doing this interview. Where do we head from here? Joining me on the program from Vermilion Research, safely ensconced in a cabin, is Dave Nikoski. Dave, let's take it from the top. As you look at this market, are what we see in now, especially with the sharp recovery that we saw the previous week, is this a dead cat bounce in a bear market, or could we be breaking out here? In other words, what are the charts telling you in terms of where we might go from here?
Yeah, you know, when we look back at other historical periods, and, you know, it's from a technical standpoint, there's not many periods that, you know, a technician can go back and look at the behavior of market participants such that we have now. Obviously, you know, when we look at this market, it's been one of the fastest declines that we've seen on record, highest volatility on record. Usually then it's a process that takes to build bottoms. It occurs over time. It's not typically a V reversal. When we look at, again, those other periods that we try to do comparisons to, you know, in recent memory, one could look back at the 9/11 crisis. And, you know, at that time, there was a popular word that was thrown about termed cocooning, which is similar to what we have now. And that's where we cancel, you know, major events. We shut down air traffic, at least for individuals, so that we don't spread, you know, in this case, the terrorist is a virus and not something that occurred, you know, in New York City in terms of buildings falling. But, you know, I think it's the same repercussions. And, you know, that took some time to get out of, and looking at other periods of market corrections to the degree that we've had, whether we look back at the, you know, 08-09 bottom, 73-74, for instance, it took time. And throughout that time that it took to develop those bottoms, we have always had a secondary retest. And I wouldn't compare, you know, I get a lot of comments from clients that, you know, back at the 18 lows, we, you know, it was a V reversal. I think that time was much different in terms of what the damage done to the market is. So I would expect some type of retest. I don't think we're out of the woods. I think the big question that we all have, and, you know, we can't see into the future, is if we can get some frontline therapy for this to treat patients prior to, you know, developing the vaccine. I think that would go a long way in providing at least some confidence to market participants that a bottom, or at least we can reduce the morbidity with those patients that are currently in the hospital.
You know, I want to go back to something you said, because in my lifetime, I haven't seen anything like this. When you talked about the fastest decline and most volatile markets on record, Dave, it's hard to believe, as we were in the middle of February, the economy was still growing. Some of the ISM numbers on service were looking good. The jobs report was looking good. And this all changed in a matter of like 4 to 6 weeks. It was one of the fastest declines. And you look at the day you and I are talking, unemployment claims up by almost 6.6 million.
Yeah, it's, you know, and even prior to what we saw in the marketplace, one has to realize that when you look at the health of the market, despite the S&P going up and having at least some constructive patterns within the small caps were far underperforming. I mean, prior to the February meltdown, when it started, you know, small caps were at 10-year relative strength lows versus the S&P. So there were certainly, in our opinion, some underlying issues that were, I think, holding the market back from ramping up further. Especially when you look at the FANG stocks prior to the meltdown, they accounted for about 67% of the gain in the S&P 500. So, you know, along with that, I think there was incremental signs that we were starting to see some pretty big divergences in the average stock versus what we saw within, you know, the large cap. So I think this helped precipitate a heck of a lot more meltdown in the small caps versus the large caps, though.
When you look at some of the other things that are also hitting at the same time, and I want to talk about the energy sector, where you've had almost a perfect storm. You've got a decline in yields. Obviously, if 50 to 75% of airline planes are grounded, if people aren't driving, Dave, I live in California where freeway log jams are the norm. You look at the freeway now, it almost looks like a ghost town. About the only thing you see is trucks on the road.
It's shocking to see that, you know, we're pursuing the new Green Deal in a different manner than what, you know, I think some of the politicians had backed. But, you know, traffic is down considerably across the world. And, you know, obviously energy prices are reflecting that. Today we had some news out that Russia and OPEC may cut production, along with at least some major U.S. providers. I've seen at least energy in some of the Canadian markets move down to, you know, $5 a barrel with, you know, outside of the it's very sour crude. But again, that's got to be way below the cost to produce it.
Yeah, because when you take a look at where the price of energy is right now, not even, you know, I've seen figures that the Saudis need $80 a barrel to balance their budget. It's less for the Russians. But even in the shale patch where you've seen, oh, we can make money at 40, well, that really doesn't take the true cost of production, which is the debt payments that many of these shale producers took on. So let's talk about crude oil. One of the things that you guys are written in a recent report is you're watching for high yield spreads to narrow and for WTI crude oil to find a bottom. Let's talk about those two things.
Yeah, you know, when we often use ETFs such as the HYG or JNK or the Bank of America High Yield Index. The problem with looking at those at a time when you see energy collapse from $50 down to $20 a barrel is it puts undue pressure in those high yield funds, because there is a portion of it that does consist of energy companies, and with the market anticipating at least a number of bankruptcies in that particular sector, I think that, you know, it's very difficult to look at these and realize that, you know, they at the rate that they're falling is pricing some of that in. So I'd like to see some stability in the high yield across the board. And again, with the energy rally that we're seeing today, that's taken some pressure off of those particular ETFs, which again, we are using as a proxy to bring down high yields. I think when we look at energy throughout history, one of the things that really stands out to me is that every time we have a major correction in it, it historically at least props up the emerging markets when you come through it, and the emerging markets often far outperform the U.S. markets. And it doesn't have to be those countries that are dependent on crude oil as a source of income. Let's face it, you know, cheap energy is a tax cut for everyone on the face of the planet. And some of the largest increases in terms of consumption occurs in the emerging markets. For instance, India, Brazil, a number of those countries also benefit, you know, greatly, at least on the consumer side.
So when you take a look at this, you know, the S&P 500 has been in a sharp downtrend since about March 4th. What would you look like, and what would be the number you would have to see that it breaks out above to tell you that this trend is reversing?
I would really love to see it break above the most recent high that we've had. And, you know, I think when we look at the, you know, one of the things I tell clients often is that parabolic moves, whether they're on the upside or downside, are very dangerous and very subject to, you know, a rubber band. And when you stretch it too far, it does come back. And I think that's what precipitated at least the parabolic decline. When we're looking at the market right now, you know, a move somewhere over 2640 is kind of our proxy to indicate that we're at least breaking the downtrend from the highs. But again, I caution that, you know, bear market rallies can take place and move anywhere from 10 to 25% before you get a secondary low. When we look at other periods with lows, whether it's 73, 74, 2008 or 2009, you know, one of the things that often occurs is you undercut the previous low by 10%. I do believe that that is still something that can occur, but realize that those are often spaced out in terms of months, or, you know, anywhere from 4 weeks to, you know, 18 weeks, 20 weeks in the case of the 08-09 crisis.
So when you take a look at where the S&P is going, you know, as you mentioned earlier, when we were looking at the rise in the S&P that was hitting all-time records, a good portion of that, around 67%, was the FANG stocks. So technology has been a strong propellant of these new records that we saw prior to this downturn. As you look at the sectors right now, let's talk about those sectors you would avoid and those that look good to you coming out of this.
Yeah, we stayed overweight technology, and simply from the fact that relative strength, you know, remains very good in the sector overall versus the market. Financials, we're underweight financials, we're underweight transports, and realize that within the confines of every sector, there is some underlying strength. We're underweight energy, we're underweight materials, but again, I'm seeing, obviously, with today's action, you're starting to see some, you know, potential bottoms be put in. I still think it's a little early there, because I think our builds in crude, and you're seeing it within the tanker stocks, are in many cases are hitting relative strength highs not seen in several years, simply as they're being used for storage offshore. Because if one looks at the curve of futures for oil, it's significantly higher than where we are now, you know, out a year. So again, I would stay underweight energy. I don't think that we've had enough bankruptcies there. Underweight materials, underweight financials, utilities, we like them, but again, they're subject to the reversals, at least on a relative strength side, at peaks, and they are as parabolic in their relative strength moves that we've seen throughout history at turning points. But I would stick with tech, and I think that's one of the areas that is aiding individuals to stay at home, whether it's Zoom. Ring just rolled out a product today to compete with Zoom. Again, I think the lockdown is going to be much longer than we anticipate, and I think technology will benefit from that. Staples, we're overweight. I would advise clients that, you know, own things where the doors are still open, and you can see that within consumer cyclical. You've seen, you know, names like Chipotle run from, you know, $800 plus dollars down to $420 at the low reverse, and, you know, now we're sitting somewhere close to, at this point in time, it's at 631. So again, stick with those things that are open, that still has cash flows coming in, whereas your sit-down restaurants, you know, I wouldn't go near them yet. I wouldn't go near the casinos. I wouldn't go near the Live Nations of the world, where every event out there has been shuttered. It's just not worth taking that risk at this time until we get some frontline therapy, and I think those will open up.
You know what's going to be interesting? I want to go back to transportation for a moment, because one sector that is on the front line of this is our truck drivers, which are in the transportation index, but you also have railroads and airlines mixed in. But it seems like the truckers, I know a lot of trucking companies, some of the states have waived the laws in terms of the number of hours, because if those truckers aren't getting food to the stores and we're all quarantined, we're in trouble.
Yeah. And truckers is an area we actually really like. And again, within that space, you're seeing of relative strength breakouts and relative strength downtrend inflections, you know, as much as, you know, 3 weeks ago, where your truckers are far outperforming. The decline in energy prices there are very, very beneficial for the truckers and puts them on par, at least, to compete with the rails. I would expect that traffic is going to be down on the rails simply because truckers can now effectively compete dollar for dollar against the rails. And again, the rails historically is something you want to own long term. Every major pullback they've ever had, you know, throughout 1968 to present, was a time to buy them, because at some point in time we will see energy prices move up, and I think more investors are going to look at them, just like they have in the past, to realize that we're not going to shut down the complete, you know, the country for period of years, but we're going to do it for, you know, hopefully less than a year, and have some solution.
Eventually, assuming that we get this under control, we're looking at two catalysts internally. One would be the lifting of the quarantine, and the second would be the flattening of the bell curve on either infections or deaths. But beyond that, Dave, what do you think is going to look good when this recovers? Because some of these businesses, quite honestly, starting with energy, they're going to go under. They may not come back. We may see restaurants that may not come back. The guy that's it was the local restaurant, maybe just he owns one restaurant, and he shut down. What happens if this thing goes on for several months? How does that guy come back?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the consumer always leads us out of any recession. And it's finding what companies can weather the storm, because through default or attrition within the industry, those that do survive are going to have at least, you know, their turnover in terms of tables in a restaurant are going to be significantly higher. And you're going to see lines at restaurants, assuming that a lot of small business owners go under, that are running restaurants. So this is truly, as we teach in school, this is truly, you know, evolution and, you know, survival of the fittest. And that's what we're going to come to. And that's going to make us stronger. It's going to make those companies much better on how they run their operations. And I would expect that those that can survive are, you know, again, with the doors open, they're going to do much better post this crisis.
As you look at this, a couple sectors that you're overweighting right now, communications, consumer staples. I mean, you know, I take a look at companies like Procter & Gamble that make Charmin toilet paper, or Kimberly-Clark that makes Cottonelle, and I'm thinking, boy, I might want to invest in toilet paper right now, given what I see in the grocery stores. But so we got consumer staples, you've got healthcare and technology. Market weight, you've got services and utilities. Let's talk about utilities and REITs, which were strong performers leading into this.
We do like the utilities. I think the one concern that I have, at least on a technical side, is that, again, they historically have these major relative strength spikes versus the rest of the market in a crisis situation. And those are the types of things that we're seeing. My other concern is that, you know, their highest profit margin business is usually to corporations, not to residents or to the consumer. And along with that, with much of the country shut down, and I think that a lot of industry is shut down, you're going to see that the most profitable portion of their business is locked in. And I think from a, at least if one were to look at it, and again, I'm not a fundamental analyst, but I do think that that causes concern for me as a technician and understanding, you know, somewhat of the 80-20 rule about how these companies charge, you know, commercial versus residential. And that would be my biggest concern from the utility standpoint. Again, it's a safe haven. We didn't overweight it. And one of the problems that I'm seeing in this market throughout even the last year and a half is the rotations when one looks at the ETFs. And in my view, when too many people are involved in ETFs and you're seeing these rotations, It, over the last year and a half, if you had stayed in utilities, you're actually not at relative strength highs. You were actually at relative strength highs in utilities versus the S&P 500 back in October of last year. And the problem is if you held utilities from a long-term standpoint over the last 18 months, you're actually just about down from where you were 18 months ago. And to me, this is kind of the black swan event that I think has crippled the aspect of ETF investing. Again, because you didn't want to own as much the electrical producers as you did the natural gas utilities. And again, with natural gas crashing, you're seeing commercial facilities being locked down. Again, I think this black swan event has disrupted the aspect of ETF investing. There's not an ETF out there that could hold all the staple stocks that would benefit from a scenario such as we've seen. And that gives me a great degree of concern when we see that type of behavior, that this is truly a stock picking environment, and picking the right names within a sector is much more important. Some of the names that we've outlined to a number of our clients, and they're not getting very good action in terms of their price performance. But when one looks at, you know, the industrial sector and looks at, you know, the air products and which does medical oxygen, as well as, you know, taking a look at something like Lind PLC, which is a foreign company that also does oxygen. They're not doing well at all. You see LabCorp and DGX doing tests on the coronavirus. They're not participating and far underperforming. We've seen, at least with your comment with Procter & Gamble, most of those large companies that make toilet paper don't actually produce the pulp. They buy the pulp and manufacture the toilet paper. A company out there a couple of weeks ago, Clearwater Paper, came out and said that the demand for pulp was, you know, something they've never seen before. So, you know, they moved from $14 to $24. They're back at $18.43. Investors that are buying the coronavirus stocks are really not pushing them out to new highs. They're just outperforming on a relative basis.
So, Dave, as we sum up, given from your perch where you see things right now, what would you be telling investors?
Well, one area that's held up really well has been gold. And, you know, prior to 2008, when you made the bottom back in November of 2008 in the market, you know, gold also plunged with it. And I think that's the aspect of what a capitulation is all about. And that's where investors sell anything they can. Gold, so far, since the plunge, gold itself has far outperformed the miners. And I still think there's benefits the miners, who one of their greatest, you know, costs into the mining is actually fuel. And I think there's a potential that they could certainly surprise to the upside with that in mind. If you look at from 08 to the bottom of, March of 09, gold far outperformed, and I don't think we're through this yet. I think that when you have governments around the world printing money in the fashion that they are, something that should offset it should be gold. And I still think that gold is a safety haven. And until we reach the bottom, gold probably will still continue to outperform on a relative basis.
Great advice. Well, listen, Dave, stay safe. And as we close, if people would like to find out more about the work you guys do at Vermilion, I mean, you really break down the market into sectors and you do quite a lot of in-depth of what markets are moving and where the money's going. And tell our listeners how they could find out more.
Yeah, our website is at vermilioncap.com, one L in Vermilion. Our number is 952-922-7500. Feel free to give us a call.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, stay safe and come back and talk to us again.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your time.
FS Insider spoke with BlackRock's Chris Donraj this week to get an update on BlackRock's outlook, what they're seeing in terms of the market impact from the economy-wide shutdown, what we're seeing in terms of the latest data from China that is giving investors some hope, and a number of other topics in this week's interview. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners on FS Insider.
So I think there's, a similarity from prior drawdown episodes, and of course the most recent one that comes up is Great Financial Crisis, in the sense that there was a market sell-off that was quite dramatic. But I think what's different here is that there is a very coordinated fiscal and monetary policy response, really drawn out of the lessons from the Great Financial Crisis of 2008-2009. So in some ways, the ability of policymakers to put in place programs to support the economy has happened, I think, much quicker than what we saw in 2008-2009. And in terms of how we think about the economy going forward, there is one distinct difference from prior episodes. And that is, we essentially have a complete stoppage of economic activity. You're starting to see, for example, last week, unemployment claims jump 4 to 5 times higher than normal, to 3.3 million people filing for uninsurance. And so I think there is this understanding that this is a severe economic shock. The fact that everything has stopped kind of all at once makes it even more acute. But this idea of coordinated monetary and fiscal stimulus allows for an economic recovery in the coming quarters.
As always, if you'd like to listen to this full interview, in addition to all of our interviews airing 3 days every week through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Energy prices have fallen tremendously since the beginning of the year. Not only are we seeing a drop in demand as a result of the coronavirus, but we're also seeing an increase in the supply with the war between the Saudis and the Russians. How far will oil prices go? What could happen to the energy sector? And what about America's independence? Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, let's start from the top. I know that at the beginning of the year, you made a forecast that oil wouldn't dip below 50, but that was way before anybody had ever heard of anything about coronavirus. Now, when you're talking about the airlines grounding 50 to 75% of their planes, you have, here in California, we no longer have freeway traffic jams because everybody's quarantined to their home. So let's begin and take a look at this from a big picture point of view. What are you seeing now, and what do you think is happening in the energy industry going forward?
So this is the fastest change in oil market fundamentals I've ever seen before. Had I waited a week to make that prediction, I wouldn't have made it. probably 1 to 2 weeks after I started really becoming concerned with what was happening with coronavirus in China. And later in the month of January, I started backpedaling on that prediction. I said, this could have really dramatic impact on the world. I was at the Money Show February 7th and gave a talk in Orlando. And I warned then on stage, I said, this is going to really potentially be devastating. I had somebody else on the stage next to me go, no, the Philippines has already found a cure. You're overstating things. And I said, I don't think so. I think this could really be detrimental, you know, especially the energy sector. That's probably the fastest falsified prediction I've ever made. But again, this is an unprecedented situation. We've seen oil demand fall sharper than it ever has. And I'm seeing forecasts now of 20 million barrels a day of oil demand decline that will hit this month. And that's just, we have no base for comparing that to anything in our experience. How low will oil go now? There was oil traded hands last week in Kansas for $1.75 a barrel. So the benchmarks right now are still hovering around 20, but there are places where it's going to cost more to store oil than it's going to cost to sell it. So I won't be surprised to see negative prices in some situations. We're just going to run out of storage very quickly with, you know, 80% of the people at stay-at-home quarantine orders and all the planes grounded this has just been something amazing to see is how quickly our oil demand fell. And Saudi and Russia really picked a bad, bad time. I mean, yes, they will increase the pressure on us for sure. They will bankrupt a lot of shale companies, but they're hurting themselves badly. Had they done nothing at all, we'd still be in a bad oil price situation, but they made matters much, much worse.
Yeah, it's almost like the perfect storm in energy. And let's talk about that conflict that's going on with the price war between the Saudis and the Russians. There's been calls by the energy industry to the president to get involved in between that conflict. There's even talk about slapping a $25 to $30 a barrel tariff on any imported oil from the Saudis or anyplace else, and then require that U.S. refineries switch to using only U.S. oil. So let's talk about that. What's that possibility? Because on the day you and I are speaking, a company just declared bankruptcy, which is the first of many in the shale patch with a lot of these companies. Let's talk about that, because this seems to be a domino effect.
Yeah, so that company, Whiting Petroleum, is one of the major Bakken oil producers, and they weren't even all that leveraged compared to some of their competitors. So, you know, if they're declaring bankruptcy, you can expect there are a lot of the weaker players that will be following suit. So I'm not normally in favor of sort of the market intervention that is being discussed here. But I will say that Saudi and Russia both back their oil industry at a federal level much more than we do. And the general public backs their oil industry more so than we do. And I've talked to people about the consequences of letting the whole shale industry go bankrupt. And some of them say, well, they deserve it. I mean, they should go bankrupt. And I can understand the sentiment, but you have to understand the national security implications of that. I mean, you know, in 2005, our net oil imports had grown to 12 million barrels a day. We were totally at the mercy of OPEC and Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. And with the shale boom, imports have fallen to just about nothing. We've become almost energy independent through the shale. And what's happening now, if all companies go bankrupt, you know, you have to look at the real implications. The real implications aren't going to be that we're all going to start driving a car. The real implications are going to be that Saudi is going to be back in control of global oil prices. And as we're still dependent on oil, you know, they will hold that trump card once again. We've got to be creative here and figure out a way to not let these guys go under. I mean, sure, some of the more irresponsible ones, they'll have to go under. But there are a lot of these guys that have been pretty responsible and going to be under a lot of pressure too here. So you have to figure out some kind of creative way to help them out.
And do you think the president will get involved in this? Or do you think also on the other side of this, the Saudis and the Russians? I mean, I've read figures that to balance their budget, they need somewhere in the neighborhood of $80 a barrel. I mean, they've got to be going through their sovereign wealth savings very quickly here at the way prices have fallen for that country.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, I mean, this is deja vu all over again. In 2014, when they did this, I kept up with the news a lot then as this was playing out in 2014. And they believed that if they dropped oil prices globally to $50 to $60, they would bankrupt the U.S. shale industry. And what happened is they underestimated the resilience of U.S. shale. And so not as many producers went bankrupt as they thought, and prices fell all the way down into the 20s. And after 2 years, they waved the white flag and said, enough. And so they had that, and that cost them, that cost OPEC probably $1 trillion in foregone revenue. And so that example was still very fresh in their minds. And I don't think Saudi wanted to go back down that path, but I think Russia forced the issue by saying, you know, we're not cutting production anymore. And I think this time Russia underestimated how severely, they could crash the price. I mean, you said a perfect storm. That's right. I mean, we had weakening demand because of this COVID-19 pandemic. And then Russia piles on by saying, we're not going to cut production. And then Saudi says, fine, we're going to open up the taps. And they crashed oil prices again. So we've been down this road before. The difference is, I don't think we're going to bounce back as quickly from this one. I mean, this crisis is ongoing. I don't see oil demand bouncing back in the next couple of months. I see, and there's going to be a scar here. I mean, there's going to be some long-term implications here that hurt oil demand for a while. So don't see the end point here. I don't see, if you ask me to forecast oil demand a year from now, that is cloudier than I have ever seen it before. I wouldn't even begin to know how to estimate that.
Yeah, because I don't think even if we clear up and maybe this virus burns itself out temporarily for this summer, I just don't see, Robert, people, getting on airplanes and going back to normal travel, people booking vacations on cruise ships. I mean, there's going to be a reluctance. It's almost like, I guess the only similarity I would say is right after 9/11, it was really hard to get people to get on airplanes.
I believe there's going to be a lingering impact that's going to hurt oil demand for a long time. Right now, I'm thinking about the NFL season, and I'm wondering if people are going to be, filling those stadiums up, or are we going to see, as you say, the virus burn out a little bit in the summer and then return in the fall, and suddenly, we find that we're having to continue, even if there's not an official policy of social distancing, a number of people are going to say, hey, I'm going to risk this. We still don't have a vaccine. The best case scenario is they find a treatment that really works most of the time. And I know there's a lot of different treatments being discussed. That is the best case. In the short term, certain drug knocks this out, reduces fatalities down to nothing, and we're dealing with more of an inconvenience than right now. We're dealing with a global health disaster.
As you look at this and the industry, we know that a lot of the shale companies, when during the downturn of 2014 and 2016, they were able to keep running because they could roll over their debt. Wall Street is reluctant to lend out or roll over that debt. So you had Whiting Petroleum declare bankruptcy today, and they weren't that leveraged, Robert. What happens to the other shale companies, number one? And number two, what about the big boys? We had Chevron come out last week. They cut back their stock buyback program by $5 billion, expenditures by $2 billion, and they're saying that that dividend is sacrosanct. So let's talk about the, let's say, smaller players in the shale patch, and then let's talk about the big guys.
Okay, so the smaller guys, I think, are in a lot of trouble here, especially those with debt. I think at the end of all this, I feel confident in saying that ConocoPhillips and EOG Resources will still be sitting. I think many of them are going to declare bankruptcy. Look at Occidental. I mean, those guys have a lot of debt now. They're a lot bigger company as far as oil production goes, but the market cap on the company right now is significantly smaller than it was before they went out and acquired Anadarko. So a lot of those smaller guys, and I'm scanning the list to see who has a lot of debt and who doesn't. And the guys with a lot of debt, they're going to be in serious trouble. Now, all of the big guys, they'll be fine. They have survived many, many ups and downs in the oil market. I don't think they've ever seen anything quite like this before. I mean, I don't think we've ever had the short-term demand destruction as deep as we've seen it, and then the lingering, the lingering impact on demand that I think we're going to see going forward. In the financial crisis, you saw oil demand drop sharply in 2008, 2009, but then it bounced back up in 2010. And if you drew a straight line from about 2000 through 2015, they jumped back up to that line in 2010. So the lost demand in 2008, 2009 was recovered in 2010. I'd be very, very skeptical we're going to jump back up to the line that we had been on, which was adding a million plus barrels a day every year for the last, 20 years. I don't think we're going to see that. We're going to see serious demand decline this year. Overall for the year, it's probably going to be down at least 5 million barrels a day over last year. And so I don't believe we're going to jump back up 5 million barrels a day next year. So it's going to linger, and it's hard to see, where we end up. So, I got real bearish over oil stocks back in February, and I started downgrading energy companies that I follow and warning people not to chase these companies down. I don't think we've seen the bottom yet. I think, the market rallied last week as the stimulus package was getting passed, but, those checks are not going to last very long, and we are going to have a lot of bad news in April. And so I won't be surprised to see the markets revisiting the lows and setting new lows in April and May. And, I don't know that for sure, but I'd be very, very cautious in this market right now. I'm urging people to kind of conserve cash as much as they can and don't try to bottom fish here too much unless they just have cash they can afford to lose.
Robert, what is this going to do to green energy? You hear politicians, depending on which party, talking about the Green New Deal, but when energy prices like this collapse, making it far more competitive, what does this do about alternative energy?
So there's two schools of thought here. One is that, yes, it makes it much more difficult for them to compete, and you can see that. But the other is that, cities like Los Angeles are seeing, clear air for the first time in a very long time. And they're noticing, the pollution down in China. And so I think one of the after effects of this will be, there'll be a little bit more impetus, I think, to go to cleaner energy, because people say, hey, yes, that was bad. We went through a bad period, but we also saw the effects of greatly reducing our oil demand. And so in the future, it'll probably be good. Right now, the renewable companies are getting hammered. The ethanol producers are getting hammered. Everybody's getting hammered. But I think probably the solar companies are not getting hammered quite as bad. That's still going to be a good industry going forward. Right now, the whole market, everything is getting hammered. I mean, there is no safe haven in this market.
Let's talk about going to clean energy. Let's say in the next 5-10 years, the transition to electric vehicles accelerates as a result. But Robert, what about the power? Because if I drive a gas-powered car, I come home from work, I park the car in the garage, I turn the engine off, it's not using up any power. I drive an EV, I pulled into the garage, I'm sticking it into a charging station. So what are we going to do if we go to EVs? You also have to have electricity.
Yeah, if there was a wide, big, huge move to EVs right now, you're right. We don't probably have the electrical capacity to support that. In the short term, it would mean, we might have to fire coal-fired power plants back up. We'd have to probably be all of the above, every way to squeeze power out. As fast as we can roll out solar and wind and so forth, we couldn't keep up right now with a massive move to electric vehicles. One of my Forbes article that published today, I said there's been two schools of thought over the years about how the age of oil ends. And one was peak oil. One was that, oil supplies peak and start to decline, and so prices skyrocket to $200 a barrel. And we sort of saw a preview of that before the shale boom. From about 2005 to 2010, we saw oil prices run up to $100 and stay there. But then in the last few years, we've seen a different vision emerge, and that was that, okay, electric vehicles are going to make oil obsolete, and ride sharing and so forth are going to make oil obsolete. And that's a peak demand scenario. And in a peak demand scenario, oil demand falls. And so in that case, prices fall. And so what we're seeing right now today with COVID-19, I think, is a preview of what that would look like. if we see a peak demand scenario, electric vehicles do come on and are rapidly taking market share away, we'll see something like this. We'll see the value drop out of the energy companies, and we'll see declining oil prices. And I felt like this probably was inevitable, but at least a decade away, at least a decade out. So you've got, that's why I'm not scared of owning a company like ConocoPhillips, because over the next 10 years, they were going to pay out, you know, something equivalent to their back to shareholders. So it's sort of a, you know, low risk investment, but not when oil is $20 a barrel. I mean, they're tooled to profit at $40, not at $20. And they're not hedged at all. I mean, some of these companies are hedged. They're one that's not hedged. We really need oil price to get back to $40 for a lot of these guys to do, you know, what they planned on doing.
I would think from a national security point of view, we do not want to go like we were, let's say, in 2008, when the price of oil got up to $150 a barrel, to go back to that dependence during the transition to Middle Eastern oil. I just don't see that. And I would think strategically, from national defense, we would want to preserve our energy production.
Yes, I mean, I agree totally. And I think the people who are saying, let the shale industry go bankrupt, are being very, very short-sighted, and they're being very naive about the consequences. I mean, a lot of them think, oh, this should just hasten our move to green power. No, it won't. It will hasten our dependence on foreign oil imports. And, you know, we've seen this movie before. We know how that is. We know if Saudi controls our oil, what we need, if they control prices, they will raise those prices as high as they feel like they can get away with. And over time, yes, we're going to keep going to electric vehicles, but we are not there yet. We still have, probably a good decade of oil dependence in front of us. So we really don't want to let these guys go bankrupt.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you're a prolific writer. You have a newsletter. You write for Forbes, Investor's Business Daily. There's a number of ways our listeners could follow what you do. How could they do so, please?
Right. So if you Google my name, Robert Rapier, and Forbes, you'll find Forbes page where I write 7 articles a month. And then I write Utility Forecaster and a weekly Stocks to Watch column for Investing Daily. And the Stocks to Watch column is free. It appears on their homepage every Tuesday. Utility Forecaster subscription column. We don't cover just utilities. We cover all sorts of income producing options, you know, real estate investment trusts and MLPs and so forth. And I'm putting out videos during this very turbulent times. I'm putting out video alerts to subscribers, advising them, especially right now, to be very, very conservative with this market. This is a very, very dangerous market right now.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me again, Jim. Anytime.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome to today's Smart Macro, where we're going to speak with our Chief Investment Officer, Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. Chris, last time we spoke with you was 2 weeks ago, and you had given us an update on the credit markets, what you were looking at to know whether or not we were going to see a bottom in the market. And as I recall, when we had you on that last time, you talked about how you thought we had seen an important panic selling low, similar to what we saw in October 2008, but that there was probably perhaps another bottom still yet to be formed, similar to what we saw several months afterwards that finally transpired in March of 2009. So give us an update on where things stand today, and especially what has happened in the 2 weeks since we spoke with you last.
Well, I think if I wanted to kind of describe what we're seeing, there's a lot of fires, I would say, that are occurring in the financial markets. And the Fed has kind of been the chief firefighter, putting out fires here and there. And that's why in the last time you and I were speaking, that was the panic lows in the bond market. Especially looking at the massive amount record outflows in bond ETFs, bond mutual funds during that week, 2 weeks ago, that I made a statement to you that I felt, you know, we're probably going to see the next move by the Fed to step in the corporate bond market. And sure enough, they did. Monday, the Fed started buying investment-grade corporate bonds. They hired BlackRock to assist them. And a lot of the deals that I was seeing the previous week, in which I was seeing phenomenal yields on A and A plus quality paper. And again, you know, when you're going through a deleveraging scenario, you sell what you can, quality, not necessarily what you want to, your riskier paper. And a lot of those deals were gone. And especially when, you know, when the Fed announces what they're going to do. I mean, I remember the famous Tepper rally. I believe he was talking about QE2, where he basically said, you know, it was a win-win scenario. And, you know, he was bullish and long. If the economy rolled over, the Fed would print. And if the economy doesn't roll over, well, earnings should rise. So it was a kind of a win-win situation. And with the Fed basically telegraphing what they do with Bernanke's Jackson Hole speech. And that's essentially what happened last week. The Fed announced that they were going to start buying investment-grade bonds. And sure enough, the amount of flows into the corporate bond, investment-grade corporate bond market surged. One example of that was a letter we sent out to clients last week, was looking at the world's largest corporate investment-grade corporate bond ETF. That's the iShares LQD corporate bond ETF. They were witnessing massive record outflows, but on Tuesday, I believe they, for the next 4 days of last week, every day they were seeing $1 billion of inflows, as investors were front running the Fed and bidding up investment-grade corporate bonds. And we did, you know, with the risk-on rally last week, we did see high yield participate, but the Fed is not buying high yield yet. And there's still a lot of potential stress and some shoes to fall. And that's one of the things that this week, Jeff Gundlach gave another webinar. And one of the things he was talking about was he was seeing over, you know, roughly $1 trillion in distressed debt, and there's still some casualties that were likely to be seen, and why he felt that it's not going to be up, up and away in the markets, that we might retest the lows, maybe even go below them. And I still think there's some companies, high quality companies, may have seen their lows last week. And that if we head lower, similar to the last bear market, think of something like a 23% of the Dow bottomed October 10th, even while the market continued to head lower. So we might have had some companies hit their lows last week. And some others, though, might follow the market and possibly head lower. There's a lot of uncertainty still ahead. We did get some great news last week of stimulus. But now the hard part, you know, that's getting that stimulus into the hands of consumers and businesses. And logistics are tough. I mean, I remember Hurricane Katrina and Rita in 2005. It took a while to get the stimulus to those states that were severely impacted. And those were a few states. Now we're talking about a national scale of the government trying to help out with getting capital and money to consumers and businesses. I don't think it's going to be smooth sailing. I think we're going to have some hiccups, similar to when the healthcare exchanges were launched, you know, under Obamacare, there was a lot of hiccups there. So I don't think anyone's really priced those potential hiccups in the market. You know, that's why I'm a little bit cautious, and, you know, why for clients, we put on a hedge this week just to protect ourselves on the downside after such a humongous rally, because we don't think it's going to be smooth sailing, that it's going to be a process.
You just sent out a piece looking at a lot of the different economic numbers. Most people are expecting we're going to see a mini depression concentrated in the second quarter with very high unemployment rates. Of course, the hope is that it is concentrated to the second quarter. What are your expectations at this point, looking out second, third quarter, or perhaps even beyond that?
Well, you know, looking at the consensus by a lot of the Wall Street firms, most of them are predicting a V-shaped recovery, economically speaking, in the third and fourth quarter. I think that's a little premature. We don't quite know when everyone's going to go back to work. I believe in California, Governor Newsom basically canceled school for the rest of the year. Now, if children are going to be staying home en masse through the rest of the school year, that's going to be putting a lot of strain on parents who are expected to go back to work in terms of daycare cost and in terms of even just not even being able to go back to work. So I think there's a lot of unknowns. And that's why I think, you know, we have to kind of temper our expectations and take it day by day. One of the things that I found interesting listening to the Jeff Gundlach webinar earlier this week was he was showing a slide essentially that he was highlighting, was saying that there was 35 million jobs that were potentially at risk in the areas that are going to be hardest hit, such as merchandise, employment services, amusement, gambling, recreation industries, education, restaurants, airlines, and looking at all these sectors of the economy, there was potentially 35 million jobs at risk. And the longer this draws out, the more that we might see more and more of those jobs lost. He was also looking at Bank of America spending data. This is just from Bank of America, looking at their credit card spending by their customers. And, you know, looking at grocery stores, year over year sales are surging. We're also seeing some, you know, decent trends in other areas. But if you look at entertainment, restaurants, cruises, lodging, airlines, some of these are seeing triple digit declines. You know, lodging for the week of 317 or March 17th was down 124% year over year. So these are some very large declines and why I would be very skeptical of a V-shaped recovery.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you on some of the hesitance of thinking that we are going to see a V-shaped recovery. I know that this week we saw China PMI numbers came out. They were higher than expected. They were positive above 50. And we spoke with China Beige Books' Shahzad Qazi about that number. He said that, no, this number is not showing a V-shaped recovery. It's a false hope that it's giving people in some headlines looking at this, saying that, hey, maybe this is a sign that other economies are going to see a swift bounce back. He pushed strongly against that in the interview that we conducted with him this week on FS Insider. So putting some context to the data, I think, is important. And another way that we can look at this is historically, when we've seen such swift market reactions or corrections in the past, if we think about 1929, 1987, what do those tell you just from a historical point of view on what we should expect in terms of the quickness or swiftness of an economic recovery as well?
You know, we do have some past historical examples to take a look at in terms of investors being shocked and how they responded after the crash. The most recent one we had was, you know, looking at the September-October crash of 08. We had the Treasury step in. The Fed was essentially getting ready to start QE1. And the market rallied into November, but then it, you know, fell again into December and ultimately didn't bottom until March. So the rally that we had going into November of 08 was very strong. And that's typically what you see after a crash, but it doesn't mean smooth sailing from that point. And that's exactly what we saw looking at 1987, post-87 crash. It was essentially the market went sideways for, you know, almost over a year. And looking at the 1929 crash, so far we're kind of acting very similar to that, where the market rallied several weeks, had a pretty good sharp rally like we've seen recently. It had about a multi-week decline, and then it rallied a little bit further. It eventually succumbed to the decline in economic activity at the time, and also the Federal Reserve and the government wasn't putting enough stimulus to offset the future Great Depression that was happening. But it does suggest that, you know, looking at crashes, there's initial snapback after the lows, but it's a process. And we saw an initial sharp rally in 1929 before we found a lower low. So, you know, these are all things that we got to be careful of just, you know, the great news was last week passed all the stimulus, but, you know, there's still gonna be some tough headlines ahead of us. But the other thing too on the plus side is that markets typically bottom before the data actually turns around. The markets are supposed to discount. So that's the thing we have to look at, and why, you know, for me, I'm looking at the financial markets to kind of get a read of, has the market discounted the worst? And are we going to see a potential bottom? Or there's some warning signs that maybe we haven't seen the bottom yet. And that's why, for me, I'm spending a lot of my time during the week looking at various types of markets, looking at the credit markets, currency markets, commodity markets, to get a handle on the potential for a market bottom or potential further weakness.
Well, one thing that you said earlier that I thought was an important point is that the Fed had to step in and essentially rescue the corporate bond market because we were seeing such a meltdown there. There was panic selling. And so the Fed stepped in as the lender of last resort to make sure that they could stabilize the amount of damage that we were seeing there. And now at this point, it looks like the junk bond market is probably going to be the next thing that we're going to have to see, is if we start to see that area melt down even further. What are your thoughts on the junk bond space, given some of the further deterioration that we could see in that area?
You know, Chris, I think you're right. The biggest rally that we've seen has been in the investment grade space. And, you know, honestly, that's actually hurt the junk bond market because you've seen money gravitate out of junk bonds into investment grade bonds, which is even putting more pressure on them. So when the Fed puts out one fire, sometimes it creates another one as people shift to where the Fed is going and not where the Fed isn't. And, you know, looking, that's one of the things I looked at this week was the response from the various high yield sectors. And we've seen a very, very weak bounce coming from the transportation high yield sector. It's almost actually at the lows of last week. Energy has had a small bounce, even with the surging price in oil today and yesterday. The energy high yield sector really hasn't shown a dramatic rally. So there's still some stress there. It's definitely, I would say, the high yield market's not given the all clear signal. When I'm looking at certain credit spreads like the LIBOR OIS spread or looking at certain swaps, they're still relatively near their lows. And one of the things I was also noticing this week was credit default swaps on both investment grade and in high yield are heading back up to the levels that they saw 2 weeks ago in terms of their highs before the market rallied. Also looking at European financials, I think we really need to watch European banks. You know, we might have some stress from European banks who are significantly more leveraged than U.S. banks, that if they run into some problems, that could lead to some counterparty risks in U.S. financials. And so that's why I'm keeping a close eye on credit default swaps for European banks and also the emerging markets with the strong dollar, which is putting stress on them. And again, all of those spreads or credit default swap spreads are heading higher back to the highs that we saw a couple weeks ago. So, you know, those are some things I'm looking at that clearly to me doesn't show an all clear signal as of yet.
Okay, so that's largely on the credit market side, and that was something that we discussed at length 2 weeks ago when we last spoke with you as to why we probably weren't looking at a sustainable bottom then. What about on the stock market side, on the equity market side? Anything that you're looking at there for signs of a sustainable bottom as well?
One thing I like to see is some bullish divergences, and what I mean by that is, for example, I mentioned that October of 2008 was the panic lows. It was the peak in stress. And while the market hit new lows, credit spreads did not. Many stocks were starting to bottom. I think even the manufacturing PMIs were starting to tick up even while the market was still heading lower. But when we finally did hit that March 2009 lows, the number of stocks in the S&P that were hitting new 52-week lows was less than what we saw in October of 2008. So that would be a case of bullish divergence. We've seen that at other significant lows in 2011, other corrective periods like 2015 going into 2016. And that's what I'd like to see is if we retest the lows and we do that with less stocks hitting new lows, that would be an encouraging sign. Even if we took out the lows and went lower, if I still saw the number of stocks hitting the lows contracting from where we were 2 weeks ago, that also would be an encouraging sign and kind of indicate that selling is beginning to dry up. And one of the things that did start to concern me this week was looking at the rally, which carried into Friday, when I looked at the market on April 1st, and we had a decline on the day. The number of stocks in the S&P that were hitting 4-week, 12-week, and even 52-week lows was the highest that we had seen since the bottom that was set on the 23rd of March. So I was seeing a higher percentage of new lows despite where we were, let's say, on the 24th or 25th when prices were lower. And yesterday on April 2nd, when the market had rallied and had a positive day, we had even more lows than what we had on the day it was declined on April 1st. So that was telling me that beneath the surface, there was some more pressure on the downside, which is why I'm not surprised the market is down today. And it does suggest that rather than going back up, I think the market wants to retest the lows.
So, Chris, I think in this environment, we all have to understand that politics are playing a very large role. You know, if the Fed is going to make an announcement, they're going to expand their stimulus by, you know, another, I don't know, who knows, $5, $10 trillion or whatever. Or if the government decides that they're going to make an announcement about another fiscal package, the markets can respond to these things very quickly, very violently. So I think that's the one caveat that we have to keep in mind as we're discussing this. But given what you said, when you look at the credit markets and when you look at the equity markets, both of those seem to be arguing for further downside.
It, you know, Chris, it, to me, I would say clearly it's not saying that the bell clear has been given. Whether we ultimately get more downside pressure remains to be seen, but there's enough weakness there that suggests to me that there's more downside risk than upside at this point. That's not going to be smooth sailing. You know, one of the things that came out this week recently was a memo from Howard Marks. He was the gentleman that Warren Buffett says, if he ever saw an email, that it's the first thing he opens and reads. And he had some very cautious comments that bears listening to. He said in his memo, "I would say assets were priced fairly on Friday for the optimistic case, but didn't give enough scope for the possibility of worsening news. Thus, my reaction to all the above is to expect asset prices to decline." And I would agree with that. I think the markets were pricing in the best case scenario, a V-type recovery. They rallied on the news of all the stimulus, but you know, there's a lot of potential downside risks that have yet to hit. And I think even really be fully priced in. We've never experienced this type of a shut-in across the country. And it's very hard for anyone to have a handle on what all the ramifications would be. And that's why I think it would be prudent to temper one's bullishness in thinking that the worst is behind us.
So, Chris, as we always do in every Smart Macro segment, as Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management, would you mind telling our listeners where we currently stand? How are we positioned with clients, given, like you said, the possibility for further downside ahead?
You know, I want to give another quote to Howard Marks. You know, I really respect his insights. One thing he said was, when everyone believes something embodies no risk, they usually bid it up to the point where it's enormously risky. And he also said, conversely, when everyone believes something is risky, their unwillingness to buy usually reduces the price to the point where it's not risky. And when you're investing, the most important thing is, are you being compensated for the level of risk that you are taking? And when you look at the investment grade corporate bond space, the high yield space, you really weren't a month ago. The amount of spread relative to treasuries was very thin. There was very little risk being priced in. However, 2 weeks ago, when we were seeing just complete panic selling in the corporate bond space, we were seeing value begin to appear again. And the amount of price decline was essentially giving you a margin of safety, or at least rewarding you for taking potential risk in high quality assets. And we did put money to work in the corporate bond space. Again, as mentioned, we were buying some A quality paper, even some triple B plus paper that was pretty solid based on our analysis over the next couple of years, very attractive prices from where they were even a month ago. And that's what our attitude's going to be, is looking at the market. And if we see companies selling at incredibly low valuations, as we did last week, we're going to be looking at deploying more capital. We're not going to try to time the market perfectly. No one can do that. But when we see attractive value and we feel that we're being, yeah, there's a certain level of margin of safety and being compensated for risk, we'll be putting more capital to work both on the fixed income side and on the equity side.
So at this point, you do have some cash on the sidelines that you're looking to deploy if we do see further downside ahead.
We do. We have both cash on our fixed income component as well as our equity component. One of the things that I'm really concerned about over the next coming 12 months is a massive surge in treasuries that we're likely to see from all the stimulus, plus our current budget deficit that we had even going into this crisis, and loss in tax revenue and expenditures increasing for unemployment claims, that we're going to have a massive wave of treasury issuance that I feel will put some pressure on sovereign bonds. If you look at German yields, if you look at Japanese yields, even long-term U.S. Treasury yields, they're well off their lows that they saw a couple weeks ago. And I think there's a lot of risk, even if the market declines, you might even see treasuries decline with them, in terms of yields rising, even while the stock market falls. So, you know, we've had a great run in treasuries, had some pretty good gains in those areas over the last year, but we are looking at reducing our treasury exposure, because I do think there's risk there, and I would rather have that cash and lock in those gains and be able to take advantage of the opportunities that we're going to see if we decline further in both the junk bond market and in the investment grade market.
And on that note, I do want to plug Jim Poplava's recent piece that he wrote called The End of Money, talking about just how low yields are, the difficulty of finding income in today's environment. A very well-written piece, gotten a lot of really good feedback from our listeners and followers. So if you haven't read that yet, we'll have a link out to that where this interview is located on Financial Sense, or you can just find it right on our homepage. Chris, let's wrap things up. If you wouldn't mind, tell our listeners how they could get in contact with you to inquire more about our outlook, what we're doing for clients, or how we can help out with their financial needs.
They can reach me by email at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can call our office at 888-486-3939.
Chris, thanks again for coming on. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to take a look at some of the charts and indicators that we have on our radar in relation to what we discussed today with Chris, just go to the show notes section under where this interview is located on Financial Sense. As always, do tell your friends and family about Financial Sense News Hour, as well as our premium weekday podcast called FS Insider, airing 3 days during the week. We always appreciate you spreading the word. And if you have any questions about what we discussed today, or if you'd like to give us any feedback, guest suggestions, or the like, you can email me directly at cris@financialsense.com. That's Chris with no H, cris@financialsense.com. You can also visit our website, financialsense.com, and hit where it says contact us, or give us a call at 888-486-3939. On behalf of Financial Sense Wealth Management, we thank you for listening and hope you have a good weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.